Welcome, everyone, to the Bereans Bible Institute. I'm Pastor Tim Warner, your teacher. Bereans Bible Institute is a ministry of Four Winds Fellowships. Our website is www.winsfellowships.net. If you would like to interact with these videos or the teaching that you're going to hear in these videos, I would recommend that the best way to do that would be to go to our website and register on the discussion forum, and there you will be able to interact with me and with others from our various fellowships. I want to thank Ben Wallach from our Peoria Fellowship for doing the teaching for module number 10 on the Kingdom of God, and I would like to recommend to all of you, if you have not gone through that series of lessons in module 10 on the Kingdom, that you do that prior to watching these videos and on Revelation. And the reason is that the book of Revelation really draws on many themes that are found in the prophets and throughout the Old Testament, also in Jesus' teaching, also in the teachings of the apostles. And it sort of wraps all these threads together into this amazing mosaic. But the problem is there is so much allegorical language we might call them word pictures. There are illustrations and metaphors and things like that that are drawn out of the Old Testament prophets, Jesus parables, and other things like that. That if you don't have the background from the Old Testament prophecies and understand where biblical prophecy is really going, which comes, you know, starts all the way back in Genesis. If you don't have that foundation and have the big picture already in place, then you're going to approach Revelation with a lot of preconceived ideas and junk that is going to keep you from understanding it correctly. It's going to trip you up, okay? So that's my recommendation. It's not a requirement, but I would suggest that you go through Module 10 first. All right, so what's the rush to get to Revelation? Why do people seem to be attracted to the book of Revelation, especially right now? You know, if you look at the world around us, things seem to be crumbling and coming apart at the seams. And I don't think anybody would deny that. There's something going on that is worldwide that is completely undermining the order of society, the spread of violence. I mean, right now, as I'm recording this, it's just days after the shooting in Las Vegas. And just prior to that, we had these massive storms that one wiped out pretty much the entire island of Puerto Rico. We had massive flooding in Houston with a previous storm, and then we had the storm that went up through Florida and did a tremendous amount of damage there. But it's not just natural disasters, and there are plenty of those, and there are more to come. But the whole world seems to be teetering on the brink of war, but not just war, for example, you know, what's going on with North Korea and all that kind of stuff, but also the crumbling of societies and the structure of governments that has been in place for a very long time. You can see this happening in Europe, in Spain right now, and in Greece, and in many other countries, in England, and so forth, that even the whole area of Europe seems to be on the verge. Turkey, you know, with its coup, attempted coup, and all the things that are going on. So everything has become much more unstable recently. And it's Jesus said something to the effect of that, you know, just before his coming, that it was going to be as in the days of Noah and as in the days of Lot. And what were the characteristics about the days of Noah and the days of Lot? Well, both of them, God was about to bring judgment, massive judgment, upon the world. And in Noah's case, the Bible says that the whole earth was filled with violence. Well, I mean, it certainly seems that way now. It seems that the whole earth is filled with violence. The good are trampled underfoot by the evil and are preyed upon by the evil. And then with regard to Sodom and Gomorrah and its destruction in the days of Lot, that's obvious. It was rampant immorality that's in your face all the time and is being promoted and pushed in public. And you just can't seem to get away from it. And we're there as well. So it is now as in the days of Lot. It is now as in the days of Noah. And the Bible warns that the same kind of judgment, that universal kind of judgment that was done to Sodom and Gomorrah by God and was also done worldwide in Noah's day, is coming again upon the world with just before the return of Jesus Christ. So, you know, anybody that's got half a brain and looks out at the world and what's going on can't help but think that we are teetering on the edge right now, and that if you believe in God and if you believe the Bible at all, and if you believe in the second coming of Jesus Christ and the prophets who prophesied about the events that are going to occur leading up to his coming, you cannot help but know, not just suspect, but know that we are very, very close to the end times and the time of tribulation and the time of the second coming of Jesus Christ. So with that mindset out there in Christianity, people are looking for answers. And in many cases, their churches are not providing them with solid answers. They just keep giving them, you know, the standard denominational party line, and then people are expected to just, you know, continue to live their lives and accept that, Jesus can come at any moment. We're all going to be raptured out of here to heaven before the bad stuff happens, all that kind of stuff. Well, I think most Christians intuitively know that the bad stuff is here. It's coming, and it's already arriving, and that we are going to have to deal with it. Well, that's clearly what Jesus taught and what the apostles taught and what the book of Revelation teaches as well. So what we're going to do in this module is I'm going to take as long as it takes to work our way through the book of Revelation. Today I'm going to be doing lesson one, which is just an introduction, sort of an overall view, kind of getting to know the Apostle John, who wrote the book, and the circumstances surrounding the writing of the book, the purpose of the book, and that sort of thing. So with that said, let's dig in. All right, number one, the author is John, the apostle, and it's the John that the Bible says that Jesus loved, the disciple whom Jesus loved. He was the author of the Gospel of John and three epistles, 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John. I have been in the process of translating the Gospel of John. I'm about halfway through that. I've already done Revelation, and I will soon be doing 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, all of the epistles, in order to complete all the books of John together. But as I've worked my way through the Gospel of John, which was written a little bit before the book of Revelation, I felt like I was getting to know the man, John, in certain ways, you know, kind of learning some of his mannerisms, his methods of speaking. He was not a polished writer in the Greek language, because Greek was not his first language. Aramaic was his first language, but he spoke Greek and he wrote Greek, but he did it with a sort of a Jewish flair to it. The Jews had a way of storytelling orally as opposed to in writing. And when people tell stories orally, they don't use what you would consider to be proper grammar. And this is true, it's true of the biblical writers, especially if they're Jewish. You'll find that the Jewish biblical writers tend to fall back into the habits that they learned from the Hebrew and Aramaic languages, and they kind of import that into Greek. And so it's not that difficult to tell when you're looking at the original languages that the Bible was written in. It's not that difficult to tell whether Greek was his first language when you look at the Greek text. And John clearly was not. It was not his first language. And he does what the typical Jewish storyteller would do, and that is he speaks about historical things and what Jesus said and did in the present tense very often as a means of making, as sort of transporting the listener into the events so that they can kind of picture them in their mind as though it's happening around them. And this was a device that the Jews used. And in fact, the books of Moses are written in Hebrew with that manner. That is, they're written, they're history, but they're written in the present tense as though they're happening at the moment they're doing it. And it's just a style of Hebrew language. And it's imported into Greek, as I said. All right, so very often we see John doing this in his Gospels. He does it a lot in his Gospel. And we also see it in the book of Revelation. The same kind of thing appears quite a few times in the book of Revelation. So anyway, I'll probably comment on some of those as we come across them, just so you're aware of them. But in any case, most of our English translations of Revelation, or even the Gospel of John or whatever, they tend to put everything in proper English grammar as opposed to following the nuances of the writers, you know, drifting from you know, historical narrative to sort of putting it in this storytelling kind of format. Now, I have translated the book of Revelation, and I'm going to be teaching the book of Revelation from my translation. So if you want to get the most out of this class, then it would be beneficial for you to have available to you my translation of Revelation. Now, you can get that, you can get a copy of that, you can download it, it's free of charge. If you go to our website, www.4winds, and that's the number four, don't spell out four. Okay, so the number four, and then winds, W-I-N-D-S, fellowships, plural, .net. Go there, click on the link that says BBI, which is Berean's Bible Institute, and you can go to Module 11, and there you'll see a link to download the Book of Revelation, my translation. Or you can click on the link that says LGV, that stands for Last Generation Version. That's the name of the translation that I'm working on. And there it just has all the various books that I've completed, and there you can just click that link and download the PDF file. I'd encourage you to print it out. You are free to print it out. You don't have to worry about copyright issues. Print it out, put it in a notebook, have it available as we work our way through. All right, so next week we're going to get into the text itself. Today I'm just going to, you know, give this sort of interview now. So you've got another week to do that. All right. Now, who is John? Who is John? We've already said that he was one of Jesus' disciples, became an apostle. He was one of, if not the youngest, of Jesus' apostles. And we know this from church history because he actually lived for about 70 years, I believe it was, after Jesus' crucifixion. So if he lived 70 years after Jesus' crucifixion, he wrote Revelation in AD 96. Jesus was crucified in AD 30. He lived to about AD 100. So if that's the case, then when Jesus was crucified, he would have probably been in his early 20s, maybe, something like that. He was just barely out of being a teenager. And Jesus called him to be his disciple. He was the younger brother of James. They were both fishermen, we're told in the Gospels, prior to this, and were taking part in their father's fishing business at the time that Jesus called them to be his disciples. Now, interestingly, we learn a lot about John just by some of his style. He never mentions himself by name in his Gospel or in his epistles. Only in Revelation do we find him mentioning himself by name in chapter 1. But the rest of the time throughout his other books, he refers to himself sort of in the third person. he uses vague terminology like the disciple whom Jesus loved. He refers to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. And he does this, I think, six times in the Gospel of John. And he also refers to himself as the other disciple, sort of like the unnamed disciple, five times in the book of John. And, you know, why would somebody do that? Well, first of all, somebody who does not like to promote their own name is probably somebody who is a rather humble person, as opposed to someone who's arrogant and proud. And I think that might be one of the reasons why the Bible says that Jesus loved him so many times. Also, because he was young, all the other apostles, almost certainly all of them, were older than him, some of them probably much older than him. And as a youth in that culture, you are to respect your elders. And so he would sort of lower himself and take the lowest place voluntarily in order to let his elders have the higher place. But as we'll see, Jesus himself chose John for a rather high honor, and that was to complete the Bible, to complete the New Testament. One of the things about John that I really love, and it's a fact that very few people really know, is that John stood with Jesus when all of the rest of his disciples abandoned him and fled. Let's take our Bibles, and I want to show you this in the Gospel of Mark. So go to Mark chapter 14. And I want to read just two verses, verses 50 and 51. This is, of course, the story of when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane with his disciples, and he prayed, and then Judas led the Roman soldiers, the Jewish officials to arrest him. And so let's pick it up in verse 50. It says, "Then they all forsook him and fled." This is after Peter cut off the servant of the high priest's ear. "Then they all forsook him and fled. Now a certain young man," notice this, "followed him, having a linen cloth thrown about his naked body. And the young men laid hold of him," that is, when he, as everyone else fled, the officials grabbed the whole of him. It says, "And he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked." Now, that's, none of the other Gospels actually mention that. Only Mark's Gospel mentions that. However, we learn who this young man was that fled. When they grabbed his clothes, he fled naked, but he quickly got something to put on, because he's mentioned again by John himself in John's Gospel. I want you to go to chapter 18 of John's Gospel. And let's look at verse 10. Now, this is the parallel account to what we just read in Luke. It says, "Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, 'Put your sword in its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup which my Father has given me?' Then the detachment of troops and the captain of the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him, and they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now it was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. And Simon Peter followed Jesus." Now, it says in another gospel that he followed afar off. Simon Peter did, that he was following, but he stayed his distance because he didn't want to be seen following. So it says, "Simon Peter followed Jesus," and notice this, "and so did another disciple." Now, again, as I said, throughout the Gospel of John, he refers to himself as the other disciple many times, and the disciple whom Jesus loved in these vague terms. And so he's referring to himself here. He says, "Now that disciple was known to the high priest and went," now notice this, you should probably underline this because it says a lot about John's character. "He was known to the high priest," so the high priest knew him. He knew who he was. He may have known his family. And he probably knew that he was a follower of Jesus, because here he is accompanying Jesus. Look what it says. "Now that disciple was known to the high priest and went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. That is, he accompanied Jesus into the courtyard where he was to stand trial. It says, but Peter stood at the door outside. So John went inside with Jesus and stood with Jesus while he was being accused, while the high priest knew him, knew who he was, and therefore knew that he was a follower of Jesus Christ. That's pretty impressive, I think. When all the other disciples feared for their lives and were gone. Then, now notice this, then the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to her who kept the door and brought Peter in. So here's John, he's a young man. Peter's probably a much older, you know, rough guy. And he's cowering outside the door, trying to just, you know, listen through the door to see what's going to happen to Jesus. John goes right in with Jesus, stood with Jesus. And now John is exposed, but he goes to the door and he gets the doorkeeper, this woman, to get Peter. And it says, verse 16, but Peter stood at the door outside. The other disciple who was known to the high priest went out, spoke to her who kept the door, and brought Peter in. Then the servant girl who kept the door said to Peter, are you not also one of this man's disciples? Are you? He said, I am not. So here he is. Here's Peter denying Jesus while he's standing at the door, just trying to overhear what's going to happen to him. He denies him, and John is not denying at all. In fact, he's exposed as a follower of Christ, and he is going to stand with him. That's pretty impressive, in my opinion. No wonder Jesus loved him. No wonder. He was a humble young man who was absolutely committed to his Lord and who apparently was not even afraid of the consequences of what was going to happen to him. So that's pretty impressive stuff. Anyway, look at John chapter 19, if you would. Verse 25. We'll learn a little bit more about John and how much Jesus trusted him. Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus therefore saw his mother, and this is, you know, while Jesus is hanging on the cross, and the disciple whom he loved standing by, he said to his mother, woman, behold your son. Then he said to the disciple, behold your mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her to his own home. Wow, pretty impressive. Now, according to church tradition that was written after the New Testament, Mary, the mother of Jesus, lived out the rest of her life. She was a widow, which is why Jesus asked John to take her in. She lived out the rest of her remaining years with John in John's home. And that was very kind of John to look after Jesus' mother. Now, Jesus had other brothers. Jesus was the oldest son of Mary, right? And we know from the Gospels he had other brothers. In fact, James, not the James, the brother of John, but another James, was Jesus' brother, his next oldest brother, that is his younger sibling. And we see in the Gospels that Jesus' brothers did not believe on him. In fact, they chided him and sort of spoke to him with scorn because they did not believe him during the time of his ministry. And we also know from Christian history that they didn't believe on him until after the resurrection. And then things changed. And so anyway, his brother James and his younger brother, maybe his youngest brother, Judah, who is also known as Jude, they both wrote books in the New Testament, the book of James and the book of Jude, both of which were written by Jesus' younger brothers. Now, it's fascinating that while Jesus was on the cross, he did not leave his mother to his younger brothers who did not believe on him. Instead, he entrusted his mother to the disciple whom he loved and whom he trusted. Very, very interesting, I think, and it goes a long way towards telling us a lot about the character of this man who wrote these books and wrote the book of Revelation. Well, John lived a long time, and that may be why Jesus chose him as a very young man to be his disciple, because his lifespan was long, and he could bear witness and bear testimony for many years after the other apostles had died, and that's exactly what happened. John lived well into his 90s, and he died at about the year AD 100, which is 70 years after the crucifixion. He wrote the book of Revelation around AD 96, which would have been 4 years before his death. He lived in the town of Ephesus in Asia Minor, in what is today Turkey. We know from extra-biblical Christian history that when the Apostle Paul was martyred at Rome, along with Peter, around AD 66 and 67, that John was, he was entrusted with sort of taking charge of overseeing the local assemblies that the Apostle Paul had started among the Gentiles, particularly there in the area of Asia Minor. And as the last living apostle, which he was, he outlived the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And once Jerusalem was destroyed, we see, and the other apostles had been executed for preaching the gospel and teaching the gospel, we see that there was a vacuum, a leadership vacuum, created of men being in authority who could give eyewitness testimony to, number one, the resurrection of Christ, but also could relay personal things that they heard from Jesus that may not even be written in the gospel accounts that we have. They could relay things orally. People could come from many miles around to see John, and they did. People came to visit John in Ephesus, sort of his headquarters there in Asia Minor, in Paul's territory. And John, sort of as a young man, Paul was older than John, but once Paul was gone, John as a younger man took over sort of Paul's ministry, that is to continue to encourage and to teach these Christian assemblies that were scattered among the Gentiles there in Asia Minor. So once the other apostles died and this situation occurred where we only have one apostle left, there were many false teachers, false prophets, and false apostles. That is, people claiming to be apostles of Jesus, claiming to have hidden teachings of Jesus, saying that, well, you know, Jesus didn't teach these things to his other apostles because, you know, they were stupid, but they didn't have that, you know, special insight. And so Jesus reserved, you know, these mystical teachings for us. And, we have these teachings from Jesus, but yet they had never seen Jesus. All right. And there was no historical record of them ever being with Jesus. What they were doing is they were taking Greek philosophy and blending it with some of the teachings of Christ and coming up with their own doctrines. And then they were going around claiming to be apostles of Christ, claiming to be prophets of God and teachers of Christianity. And in fact, they were perverting that. And a lot of that was going on even while Paul was still alive. But after Paul and Peter were dead and the other apostles appear to be off the scene, this sort of just exploded all over the Christian world there. And we had these false teachers, false apostles invading Christian churches and leading many astray. You know, Peter warned that was going to happen in 2 Peter chapter 2, and that's exactly what did happen. We know that it did happen because the book of Jude tells us it happened. Jude was written after the destruction of Jerusalem. Again, Jude was a brother of Jesus, not an apostle, but he indicates that what Peter said was going to happen was already happening. All right. Anyway, one of the things that I noticed about John's gospel when I was translating John's gospel is that there are the themes that are interwoven throughout John's gospel are all supportive of the teachings of Paul. Paul got deep into theological teachings about Christ, about who he is, about his preexistence, about the fact that he came down from heaven. In 1 Corinthians, he talks about, you know, Adam being the man of earth, but Christ being the man from heaven. And John's gospel, what he does is, as Paul's teaching was beginning to be corrupted after Paul was gone by these false teachers, John then steps in and he begins to put down some things in writing from his own eyewitness testimony. And so what does he do? He doesn't just, like the other, you know, the other gospel writers, their intent was to just, you know, lay out what they remembered about, you know, their, while they were with Jesus, what they saw and they heard. But John is much more selective in the things that he wrote down that he remembered, because John remembered a lot of things that Jesus said, that John the Baptist said, and things like that, that the other gospels don't report. And what John was doing was he was choosing those things to write in his gospel that provided concrete support for what the Apostle Paul had been teaching throughout the Gentile world, and, you know, in his letters and also in person. And so John's theology in his gospel is packed with information, with eyewitness accounts of Jesus' words and things like that, in order to support and validate for these Gentile churches, these Gentile assemblies that Paul had established, to validate that what Paul taught to them was indeed exactly true, and it was consistent with what Jesus himself taught. Because remember, Paul was not taught specifically by Jesus while he was here in the flesh, right? Paul became an apostle of Christ after Jesus' ascension. He was called on the road to Damascus. And so there was a lot of challenging of Paul and of his theology, particularly because he went much deeper than the other apostles did in these theological themes, and provided a lot more detail about who Jesus was and is for us. And so John spent a great deal of time in his Gospels and also in his 1st, 2nd, and 3rd epistles in validating the teaching of Paul. But it's not just the teaching of Paul in general. It's the teaching of Paul regarding the person of Christ. That is, who is Jesus? The most important question in the world is, who is Jesus? And Paul had a lot to say about that topic. And John reinforced what Paul had to say. And we see this all throughout his gospel. Well, we also see it in Revelation. And what I want, the reason I spoke about all that is because the book of Revelation is not named the Revelation of Jesus Christ for nothing. See, a lot of people, when they read Revelation, they think it's the revelation of the end times. No, it's not. It does contain information about the end times, but most of it is not new. Most of it is drawn out of the Old Testament. All right? It is the revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, a lot of Christians, when they look at that, they think, okay, well, it's the revelation of Jesus Christ. It's talking about his second coming. Well, that's only a small part of it. The revelation of Jesus Christ is the unveiling of Jesus himself, the unveiling of who he is in all of his majesty, in his role since creation, in his role at the Father's right hand, in his role in the time of tribulation, unleashing the seals of judgment upon the earth, in his role as King of Kings and Lord of Lords when he establishes his kingdom upon the earth. So the book of Revelation is really a book about Jesus himself. All right, so it's a complement to the Gospels, the Gospel of John in particular, and it's a complement to all of Paul's teaching regarding Christ. All right, now, John in his later years didn't just sit around twiddling his thumbs waiting for people to come and ask him questions and hear stories about, you know, when he was with Jesus when he was a young man, and, you know, what did Jesus say about this and what did Jesus say about that. All right, he didn't just sit around doing that, although that did occur. But John also took it upon himself to train other disciples. Now, he's not the only apostle to do that. The apostle Paul did that as well. They followed Jesus' example. See, Jesus chose some men, and he invested his life and his teaching in those men, because 12 men could go out then into the world throughout the rest of their life and do a whole lot more than one can do, right? So that's what he did, training those 12 men. Well, Paul did the same thing. He took some men with him. You remember on his missionary journeys, he took John Mark at one time. He took Barnabas with him. He took Silas. He chose Timothy while he was out preaching. He came across this young man, Timothy. And being a young man and being well-educated in the scriptures and becoming a new Christian, he was very valuable to the Apostle Paul, because Paul could then invest himself in training Timothy as a young man, so that when Paul was off the scene, the work that he started could continue. It would not succumb, hopefully, to, you know, all these false teachers, false apostles, and so forth, Satan going around trying to destroy what God had done through the Apostle Paul. And instead, there would be more men to carry on the fight. And so Paul did that. Well, John did that also. And we learned from Christian history, right after the close of the New Testament, several writers came forward and wrote epistles, and these men were students of John. And it's fascinating to read some of their writings, because there is so much of John's lingo from his Gospels. For example, referring to Christ as the Logos, the Greek word Logos, which means the Word. We see, you know, John's Gospel starts out, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made through him. Without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life." And it talks about the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We beheld his glory, and so forth. All right, so we have John referring to him as the Word there. We get into the book of Revelation. Oh, by the way, the Apostle Paul also referred to Christ as the Word, or Logos, in the book of Hebrews. And in the book of Revelation, John makes it crystal clear that the Logos, in John chapter 1, verse 1, that Logos is a proper name for a person, Jesus Christ, because in chapter 19, when he's describing the second coming of Christ, coming, splitting the sky open and coming on a white horse, it says his name is called Logos, or Word of God. His name is called. So it's clear that Logos is a name. So you see the book of Revelation sort of rounding out. With its theology, it will round out the teachings of the Gospel of John and the Epistles of John, which actually have their genesis in the teachings of the Apostle Paul, who taught prior to John. Okay? Hope you guys understand that, because as we go through the book of Revelation, I'm not just going to be talking about end times. I'm going to be talking quite a bit about the Godhead, about what John's books reveal about the Godhead, but most importantly, about who Jesus is. Okay? So I hope you look forward to that. We'll actually be getting into that next time, as we get into chapter 1, because there's a significant amount of that right there in chapter 1. Anyway, as I was saying, John trained some of these men. Men like Papias, men like Ignatius of Antioch, men like Polycarp of Smyrna. And these men wrote after John's death. They wrote, they were his students. And so there's much valuable information about how they interpreted the book of Revelation and all of John's teachings, but particularly the book of Revelation. Because the guy who wrote, the guy who saw the visions, the guy who wrote down the book of Revelation actually taught some of these men. And then their teachings are out there in writing, and we can actually read their teachings. And so that gives us a great deal of advantage in how we understand the book of Revelation, because we also have John's students to read. Okay? Now, we're not going to spend a lot of time reading, you know, quotations from them. We will occasionally. But I want to focus primarily on what John wrote. All right? Now, during John's last decade, probably somewhere around AD 90, he was arrested, and he was tortured. The tradition has it that he was boiled in oil or tar or some kind of substance like that. But he survived it. No doubt he survived it miraculously, but I don't believe he was unscathed by it. He probably was scarred rather severely. But because he survived it, I believe he was, instead of trying to kill him again, he was banished to the prison island, the Greek island of Patmos, which was a prison camp, kind of like their Alcatraz. And it was a mining island, and it was forced labor. And here's John, an old man, probably beginning his 90s, and he ends up, you know, in hard labor on a prison island. And while he's there suffering for the word of God, he has these amazing visions, which are recorded in the book of Revelation. Now, what's so fantastic about these visions? Well, for one thing, what's amazing about them is that they contain several times, they actually contain large segments that are the words of Jesus himself, that he spoke to John from heaven in order for John to write them down and send them to these local assemblies. And for example, chapters 2 and 3 are letters to the local assemblies, and Jesus gives his assessment of where those local assemblies were with regard to their commitment to him and how they were doing. He says, "I know you. I've watched you. I've seen your works. I've been observing you." Right now, Jesus is appearing to John around AD 96, which is like 66 years after his ascension to heaven to be seated at the right hand of the Father. And here Jesus is communicating these things by vision through the holy breath of God to John. And he's given these assessments of current events that were going on in these seven local assemblies that were around. You know, Ephesus was one where John was, but also these other assemblies that were in the vicinity of Ephesus. And he's talking about current events, and he's talking, and he names members of the congregation by name. That's pretty interesting stuff, isn't it? Jesus, wouldn't you like to have Jesus' personal assessment of your assembly? Maybe we wouldn't. Well, it would certainly wake us up, wouldn't it? Well, that's what Jesus did. He gave his personal assessment, and he had it sent by these messengers to these various churches, after John wrote these things down. And this is a very, very, very important point, because it shows Jesus is still alive in heaven, and it shows that he's paying attention to every local assembly. Everyone, he's watching. By means of the Spirit, he's able to see and hear what's going on in our local assemblies. And that ought to be something that really, shakes us to the core. It really should, because it's not just those that he's watching. He's watching us as well, and we need to be careful with that. All right, well, understanding Revelation is really a simple task once you understand a few basic points. All right. First of all, you have to understand that the book of Revelation is not a shortcut. to understanding Bible prophecy. If you don't do the hard work of understanding the previous prophecy, you're not going to get Revelation. It's a riddle to be solved. It can be solved only by understanding the pieces. The pieces are drawn all from the Old Testament prophets. They're drawn from the teachings of Christ. And they're drawn from the teachings of the other apostles. Okay? That's a critical point. You know, Paul, if you listen to my teaching on the book of Hebrews previously, I made a big deal about the fact that Paul used a form of teaching that was common among the rabbis, where he would quote short sections from the Old Testament in order to make his argument, but he doesn't draw all of it together. He just quotes a brief section of it, expecting his Jewish Christian readers to know the passage that he's quoting from and to understand what that was all about, that passage, and then to bring that to the table and understand the point that he's trying to make by simply referencing these scriptures. It would be sort of like, you know, a pastor who's preaching a message and he just mentions the references of certain passages in the Old Testament and expect that his students know those passages, you know, almost by heart, but at least know them and know the basic content of what's in them. And this is the way Paul taught. Well, John kind of followed Paul's example with that regarding the book of Revelation. And he does this repeatedly. He draws little quotations and allusions from statements in the Old Testament prophets, and he then weaves them together in the end times. Now, is he saying that everything he's quoting from the prophets, that those prophets were talking about the end times? No, and that's a mistake that some people make. They think that, okay, well then, if he cites Isaiah, you know, say, I don't know, chapter 45 or something, that Isaiah 45 must be about the end times. No. What he's doing is he is taking, in many cases, not in all cases, but in many cases, he's taking the prophets who prophesied about their own contemporary situation. For example, the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, or the restoration of Israel and Jerusalem that was granted by the Persian king Cyrus, or statements from Ezekiel, or statements from Zechariah, particularly Zechariah. In fact, many, if not most, of the quotations or allusions to Old Testament scripture in Revelation come from Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Zechariah. Now, there are also some from some of the other minor prophets and so forth, but what we'll see is the majority of them, and the most important ones, come from those three prophets, and also from Daniel. I left Daniel out. Okay, so those four prophets. So they draw on, Revelation draws on those prophets. And so you have to not only understand the Old Testament prophecies about the end times, you also have to understand the Old Testament prophecies about their Israel's contemporary situation during that prophet's lifetime, the historical situation that was going on, and why that prophet refers to certain symbolic things, or he sees visions about, you know, certain things, like, you know, Daniel's visions with animals and, you know, beasts and all this stuff, and all that. Or you got Zechariah's vision about the two olive trees that are dripping oil into a lampstand, you know, and all that. And who are these two olive trees? What do they represent? Well, they represented two prophets, the prophet Zechariah and the prophet Haggai, who were both prophesying during the rebuilding of the temple. And if you understand these Old Testament prophets and their current situation and what was going on while they were rebuilding the temple at the end of the second exile, then you'll see that when the book of Revelation then draws the same themes and applies them to the last days, that it's not saying that what happened there is what's going to happen here. What it's saying is the circumstances that occurred back then are going to be repeated. That is, the end time scenario is going to be similar. So if you understand the symbolism and how it was applied to the historical situation, then when the same symbols are used in the book of Revelation, what that means is what's going to happen in the future during the time of tribulation is going to mirror or mimic what happened during these historical times. And those historical times are primarily the destruction of Jerusalem, the rebuilding of Jerusalem by through Cyrus and his decree, and also the events that occurred a few hundred years later with Antiochus Epiphanes and the abomination of desolation that occurred during his reign when he came in and tried to desecrate the temple, and he put up the image of Zeus and sacrificed a pig on the altar. And the whole story of Hanukkah, if you're not familiar with it, you need to be familiar with it because it's very important to understanding Revelation and also the teachings of Christ on the end times. You need to understand that. So all those themes from Israel's history and from the prophets interacting with Israel's history are woven together in the book of Revelation to paint a picture of what the end times are going to look like. If you want to understand, if you want to have foreknowledge, if you want to have forewarning about what's coming in the end times, then these are the things you have to know and understand, and this is how you have to approach the book of Revelation. Okay? Well, I'm going to stop there for today, and that gives you sort of an overview of our author, John, and his life, his nature, his character, his mission, and also his style in how he has communicated these visions of the end times, and particularly the picture he paints of who Jesus is. All right? So God bless you all. Come back and check for the next lesson next week, and we'll go from there. All right? God bless you all.